Welcome to Coastal Cafe. I'm Marianne Wagner, your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington's College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. I have with me today Dr. Graham Young with the University of Washington and Dr. Rick Goetz with Northwest Fisheries Science Center. Rick has been the leader of the program in aquaculture and marine fish and shellfish biology at the Northwest Fisheries Science Center for the past 10 years. Prior to that, he was a professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at the University of Wisconsin and director of the program in scientific aquaculture at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Graham is a professor in the School of Aquatic and Fisheries Sciences at the University of Washington and the executive director of the Western Regional Aquaculture Center. He has held faculty positions at the University of Otago, New Zealand, and the University of Idaho. Welcome, Graham and Rick.
Hi.
Hey there.
Historically, the Northwest has been home to a thriving native sablefish population. With a market value of over 100 million annually, sablefish have potential for commercial aquaculture. Sablefish are also known as black cod. Is that right, Rick?
Yes, it is.
What other names does this fish go by?
Sometimes it's called butterfish, especially in the Hawaiian Islands. But it's generally called black cod.
And it's a popular fish on the table, isn't it? I mean, restaurants, et cetera.
Yeah, it's a kind of a niche market for it in the U.S., but it is very popular in Asian countries such as Japan, China, and Korea.
In partnership with NOAA Northwest Fisheries Science Center and the Jamestown Sklallam Tribe, you have been the leads on a pilot experiment to grow sablefish to commercial scale quantities. Can you tell us a bit about the pilot project, Graham?
This is a culmination of research that has gone at the NOAA research lab at Manchester since probably 2010, 2011, when Rick was recruited. So the first efforts were directed towards really technological improvements in culture. So a lot of really hardcore fundamental research to overcome roadblocks. Rick can elaborate on this endlessly, probably. and this eventually culminated in a project that was has been partially funded by Washington Sea Grant to partner with the Jamestown Sklallam Tribe to assess basically this as a candidate for commercialization. And so the project is coming to an end right now, and then Rick can probably tell you more about where we are with that. So it has been a long project, that's for sure.
Well, it's a fabulous project. And Rick, you've mentioned that sablefish are native to the Pacific Northwest. Are fishermen still fishing for wild sablefish off our shores in Washington state?
Yeah, there's commercial fisheries off of the Washington coast. It's also off of British Columbia. But the largest commercial fisheries for sablefish is in Alaska. So that's the predominant one. But there still is a commercial fisheries in Washington as well. It's about 10,000 to 20,000 metric tons per year. But if you compare that to something like pollock, which is about 1 million metric tons per year, it's not very big.
Well, and Graham, as you were just saying, the overarching objective of this research is to determine the sustainability from an economic, environmental, and societal perspective of growing sablefish as an industry. It simply isn't known yet whether it would be sustainable. And that is the aim of this pilot project. Is that correct? Am I framing that correctly?
Yes, I think that is entirely correct. You know, when we talk about sustainability, it's really a many-headed beast. Environmental sustainability means different things to different people, but I think you have to take a big step back and in terms of sustainability, the environmental aspects, you know, not creating significant disturbance to the ecosystem, not causing loss, irreversible loss of biodiversity, et cetera. That's, you know, the environmental aspect. But we could probably grow many, many fish. Whether you can do it economically is really a key. And so that's really been, you know, the focus of this project. You know, this is probably one of the few projects in which we've been able to start to assess before at the site when the no fish present, during the grow out of the fish and afterwards. And so our colleague in my school, Dr. Lorenz Hauser, is actually leading a project to look at how at the sediment under the net pens. And so this really will be, I think, one of the first examples of really monitoring very closely what happens as fish grow and as you harvest and how that site recovers.
Yes, you actually mentioned that one of the aspects of the pilot project is assessing the environmental impacts. And how is this being assessed? I understand you are monitoring the sediment and the sediment fauna below the net pens. What exactly is being looked at?
Yeah, well, I'll let Rick elaborate on that, but really, okay. it's bringing some pretty advanced molecular tools to look at the communities. But Rick, you know more about this.
Yeah. Lawrence and some of his colleagues have been taking sediment samples underneath of the walkways of the net pens. And as Graham mentioned, they did that prior to putting the net pens in and the fish during that time. Even though we had COVID restrictions, we were able to do that. And then right to the point now where we're harvesting fish, and then it'll be probably 6 months after that to see the after effects of taking the fish out and not having the pens in there. They sample normal things like the dissolved oxygen, different aspects of the sediments, the grain size, is there a change in that? But the kind of novel thing about this study is they're using, as Graham said, advanced molecular techniques to identify the organisms that are in the sediments. And instead of really just looking at the organisms themselves, they're looking at their genomic signatures, like that is the DNA of those organisms. And by doing that, they can completely identify all of the organisms in the sediment, particularly the microorganisms, and to see if those organisms change over time in relationship to when the net pens are there and when the net pens are removed, that type of thing. So it's a really interesting use of modern molecular techniques to do this kind of sampling. Whereas in the past, they only were able to look at organisms that could identify, say, under a microscope and with that kind of technique. So it's pretty advanced and it'll be very interesting.
So yeah, it sounds like it hasn't been done before.
Yeah, I think it has been done a little bit. I'm not going to say this has never been done, but as Graham mentioned, the novel thing about this study is that it has been done prior to, during, and after the net pens and their deployment. And that part has never been done. Usually it's done only as a one-time snapshot.
And Graham, you have mentioned that it could be economically prosperous as an industry. What are the criteria for assessing whether this endeavor would be economically worthwhile?
Sure. Well, you know, like any economic analysis, it's, you know, what are your inputs? What are your outputs? What are your profits? So in this case, we know how many fish went in. We know how much feed has gone in. We know what comes out at the end during the harvest. And then, you know, it's down to the market. And so that assessment is actually, that economic analysis will continue as we get more information from the processes, for example, about the quality and the wholesale price, et cetera, et cetera. It is a very high value species. I think you will find sable fish fillets in the U.S. market for maybe $20-$25 a pound. So it is a very high value species.
It's in demand.
And it's in demand and it's delicious.
It also has the potential benefit of producing locally for our citizens an abundant and safe seafood option for consumers. I'm thinking of the tribes in the region who might benefit from having this aquaculture industry in Washington State. Can one of you touch on that?
Yes, I think that there have been tribes in the past who have fished sable fish commercially, not aquaculture, but actually gone out and fished them. And one example is the McCalls. And they have fished them for a number of years. I think some of the other tribes have not really fished sable fish, but maybe salmon primarily. But there are tribes like the Jamestown Tsklallam tribe in Squim who are really interested now in diversifying to growing other types of seafood like shellfish, which they have done in the past, but also sable fish. And so that particular tribe is very interested in the prospects of aquaculturing sable fish. I mean, the other thing that we mentioned briefly, but it's very important, is that sable fish is a native species to the Pacific Northwest. And so by aquaculturing that fish, you are not introducing any non-native or unusual fish to the area. And in discussions with the tribes, this is a very important aspect, that it is a native species.
Really important aspect of it. And in fact, you are partnering closely with the Jamestown Tsklallam tribe. And what are the potential benefits for the tribe as a partner?
I think the benefits for them is, as I mentioned, a lot of the fish and the seafood that they have gotten commercially before in the past are not available anymore. And yet they still want to derive, resources or food from the sea. And one of the only ways to do that, because of the decline in the commercial fisheries, is to be able to do aquaculture. So it benefits the tribe by being able to continually sustain their use of seafood or their having seafood in their diet. And also, it's in certain areas, it is close to where they are. For example, the Jamestown Tsklallam, where they're interested in doing aquaculture sable fish, would be in the Port Angeles area. So it is close to where the tribe is, and it's something that they could develop over time. So I think it's important for them to continue sustaining the seafood that they have as an individual and as a tribe.
And the intent of this pilot project, or the project technology that you're developing, is to transfer this technology over to the tribe. Is that accurate? You're sharing with them, essentially.
Yeah, maybe Graham could talk a little bit about this.
Sure. Very much the tribe's very much a partner in this, an active partner. I think what I maybe would like to just continue from something Rick mentioned is that I think there's a recognition within the tribe of looking to the future, not just this generation. As anyone who's ever heard our dear friend, late friend, Kirk Grinnell talk, a tribal council member who really was very instrumental in the tribe's involvement, he always emphasized, we are looking at 6-7 generations ahead. And I think most people, in this area recognize that this is where seafood production, it has to go, as we have this growing population, just generally in a global sense.
Thank you. It sounds like there are potentially many wonderful reasons for developing aquaculture operations for sable fish. So Graham, why hasn't this been done before?
Well, I want to just correct something there. Sablefish aquaculture does occur in Canada. There are, I think, a couple of companies. Rick can correct me. And in fact, this team has actually engaged and partnered in some aspects with those enterprises. I don't want to get too geeky here, but there are attributes of marine finfish that are quite challenging to in terms of development of culture systems. Salmon, for example, that's probably the easiest fish in the world to grow commercially. There's various aspects, but Rick can talk about all the challenges perhaps later, but the early larval development, the, manipulation of the adults, the, get them into a reproductive condition is much, much more challenging than you see, for example, with that, the large Atlantic salmon industry, worldwide. I think also it's just, you also need someone who's got a vision and who sees, the opportunities. And this is the case with the tribe, I think. You just need a very willing partner and an engaged partner, I think.
If you're just joining us, this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and I am Marianne Wagner, today's host of Coastal Cafe. I have with me today Dr. Graham Young with the University of Washington and Dr. Rick Goetz with Northwest Fisheries Science Center.
Yeah, I think going on with what Graham said, there is a pretty good company already in British Columbia, and there has been in the past several others, and I think there's a new one joining that as well. So there is or has been aquaculture of sablefish. There has also been some production of fingerlings in the U.S., but there has not been yet what we call grow out. So the word grow out means taking a fingerling, a very small fish, up to a commercial product or size. And that's the one thing that's been missing in the U.S. I mean, we have, and I say we, NOAA and NOAA's partners at UW and also at the Jamestown Squalum tribe have developed the techniques to grow these fish, going through all of the larval stages, et cetera. But really where we're missing is this grow out phase. And that goes all the way back to this project that we're doing right now. We really needed to develop a grow out platform, which happens to be NetPens, in order to show that we can do this successfully. Now we're still in the process of doing it, but this was a really important and crucial part to the whole puzzle.
Thank you. Well, your team is working hard to overcome all these hurdles to producing sablefish at commercial scale, and you've applied several technologies and innovations. So what are some of the creative solutions you've come up with to solve the challenges?
Yeah, there have been a lot of challenges, particularly at the early life stages. And that, as like Graham has mentioned earlier, it's very different when you're rearing a marine species versus a fish like trout or salmon. They don't have the challenges that these marine species do. And a lot of those challenges have to do with when they're very young. They're only like an inch long or less than an inch long. And they're feeding on what we call live feeds because they can't eat artificial diets right away. So that part of the production is costly. It has a lot of little innuendos associated with it. And one of them is that you have to add algae usually to the water for these larvae, not for them to eat, but for them to see prey or their food against the background. And you don't realize it, but that algae costs a lot of money. And one of the investigators, Dr. John Lee at the Manchester Research Station where I work, found that he could use clay in place of the algae. And if you start to price out these two things, you'll find that clay doesn't cost anything and algae is costing thousands of dollars buy it. So this is one of the innovations that I think is super important. And I'll just mention the other innovation that's been developed primarily by Dr. Adam Luckenbach and William Fairgrave at NOAA is the use of all female sablefish in grow out. And so why do we do that? It's because females grow faster than males. And so if you just stock females, you're going to get to a commercial product much more quickly than you would if you stocked a mixed sex like males and females together. And that's another innovation that I think really will push this whole thing forward, this whole aquaculture of sablefish.
So Graham, could you give us a brief explanation of what is generally meant by offshore aquaculture? Moving on to some of the terms.
Again, it means many different things to different people. I think the definition probably the U.S. when we talk about offshore aquaculture, we're really talking about open ocean aquaculture. That is usually conducted in the, EEZ, in deep water, whereas pretty much all the examples we have in the U.S. and pretty much worldwide, we're really talking about production in fairly protected coastal areas, areas like Puget Sound, the fjords of Norway. So, but these are site limited, of course. So if you, any further expansion really is going to require that we move offshore. There are incredible technological challenges if you can imagine how dynamic and how extreme those environments can be compared to Puget Sound, for example. So incredible engineering challenges, a lot of really innovative ideas being explored right now. But again, and Rick may correct me, I don't think there's really that big a significant, truly offshore industry right now. But it certainly interests across the globe in developing these technologies.
In line with that, a few years ago, one of the partners, Cook Aquaculture, was embroiled in some controversy about rearing non-native Atlantic salmon in these net pens offshore, but which the tribes were not at all involved in. But Cook has worked to resolve those issues, I understand, and now is focusing on other projects. And they're a partner of sorts on this project. And how have they been contributing to it?
You know, Rick may be a better person to answer that at this point. But in fact, Cook has been interested for many years in sablefish, but I'll let Rick elaborate because he's very much knows the history a little bit better than I do.
Yeah, so Cook and the Jamestown Skalum tribe, and I'm going to say this is probably a year ago or maybe even further, just before COVID, signed a business agreement together, and that was to rear native fish species in net pens in Puget Sound. And at that time, they were thinking of steelhead trout, triploid steelhead trout, and they still are. But it also included sablefish. And that's, I think, primarily because the Jamestown Skalum tribe was involved in that. So, in fact, there is a business agreement that exists already between the tribes and Cook. And so they are helping one another to establish that. Cook has been really helpful for our project, and they have been a collaborator with it. And they have done things like help clean the nets in the net pens. They're helping us harvest the fish. We can use sometimes their boats to move nets around or weights. So they've been invaluable, like for this project. And without them, I don't think we would be successful at all. And so that thing will go forward, I'm sure, that business agreement.
Well, you are using net pens for this project, but how do they differ from those offshore net pens we were just talking about? Are there differences?
Yeah, our net pens are really what we call experimental. So if if you look at our net pens, the whole perimeter of the net pen is 80 feet by 80 feet by 20 feet deep. And it consists of four individual net pens inside that are 40 feet by 40 feet each and 20 feet deep. So put that in perspective, that space and the amount of fish that you would put into that net pen goes into one net pen of a commercial producer like Cook. And they would have like 10 of those net pens hooked together. So what we're trying to do is to use our net pens really as a quasi-commercial scale production. We must get to the point where we're actually doing things in net pens, but we could never sustain the kind of size that a commercial net pen would require. So that's the difference. And this is in comparison to what Graham was saying, net pen systems that are in protected areas like Puget Sound and the fjords.
Well, during COVID, like many researchers, you had some difficulty keeping the project going forward, what with restrictions and lack of access to the labs. But you also had a new challenge with the net pens involving a rather large mammal in recent months. What was happening?
Yeah, sea lions, there's a lot of them in Puget Sound, and they knew that we had fish. The fish were getting bigger. They keyed in on them, and they wanted to get in the net pens and eat them. And sea lions can jump really great distance. And so what they would do is jump over the walkways into the net pens. And so it's very difficult to try to keep them out, but they knew the fish were in there. And so that was sort of our challenge.
Well, I understand you had Graham come out with his boat at one point, and you are trying to, I don't know, you'd have to explain what you were doing.
Yeah, Graham was really, really helpful. And we used his boat to actually put a barrier around the net pen so that they couldn't jump as easily over the walkway. So
it was an interesting Saturday, let's put it like that.
All in the name of research. Well, thank you, Graham and Rick, for sharing the details on this exciting project to develop a new industry around sablefish and for giving us an insider view of what a fisheries research project looks like and the many challenges that you have been working on to overcome. This is Marianne Wagner, and you've been listening to Coastal Cafe, a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the UW College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Washington Sea Grant helps people and marine life thrive by providing research, technical expertise, and education that support the conservation of our ocean and coastlines. I'd like to thank our station manager, Larry Stein, and production engineer, Jared Dufresne. And as always, a special shout out to the band Kooeaks for sharing their music with us at the open and closing of this program. And thank you for listening. Have a good day. Get on me. How do I see you?